This Twin Peaks Investing Podcast is brought to you in association with SharePad from ShareScoop, the UK's number one investment data and analysis software for private investors and traders. Visit ShareScoop.co.uk and discover the advantage.
Hello and welcome to the Twin Peaks Investing Podcast. This is podcast number 45, and I'm very, very pleased to tell you all that we have a guest with us today. We like to shake things up, and I was given a great opportunity today to have somebody on the show, and they've agreed to come on, and they're going to be with us in about 15, 20 minutes. I won't tell you who that person is yet, and I'll introduce him later on. I'm sure you'll be thrilled to hear what he's got to say about various things regarding the markets and other aspects of stuff. But first and foremost, I wanted to say hello to my good friend, Pete at Wheelie Dealer on Twitter. My name is Peter Higgins at Conkers3 on Twitter. Pete, how are you, mate?
Yeah, not bad. Well, you know, I say not bad. As you know, I've had this ongoing sort of health aggravation that's been sort of making things a little bit harder than I'd like them to be. But, you know, I mean, I'm fine in the sense that, you know, I'm sleeping fine, I'm eating fine, everything's fine. But I've just got this sort of like awkward pain, which is making it difficult to do things. So, yeah, it's a bit tedious, really.
I'm not trying to be flippant now, but the awkward pain isn't been the volatility of the markets giving you a jab in the hip, is it?
Do you know, it's funny, it always gets worse when the markets are funny. Funny that, isn't it? Yeah, funny.
It's a recurring thing, mate. It's the anniversary of the market dip, mate. March 23rd, 24th, when the markets were getting hammered in 2020.
Yeah, it sends my stomach into a spasm.
Oh, boy. Right. So, Pete, we've got a guest on, so we just want to cover a few bits and pieces beforehand. Where do you want to start, mate? Do you want to talk a little bit about the political roadmap, or do you want to skip all that and just cut to the chase? What do you want to do?
Well, you know, I mean, I think in terms of the politics, it's, you know, we're sort of like just really waiting, aren't we? I mean, we all sort of hope and pray that lockdown is going to be eased on the kind of timetable they've said. But, you know, it's not definite, is it? I mean, it's probably going to happen that way, because I think once they've given a date, it's hard for them to renege on that. And obviously there's enormous pressure on Boris and stuff from the backbenchers in the Conservative Party. But, you know, so we're really just sort of waiting for things to open up. And obviously the situation with travel and that has got quite interesting, because I think I tweeted about it actually just before, you know, about an hour ago before we started this call. We're doing this call on Wednesday. Is it Wednesday 24th of March? Yeah,
it is Wednesday 24th. Yeah,
24th. Yeah, and it's getting up nearly 6 o'clock. And I tweeted out earlier that Boris was talking to the liaison committee in the House of Parliament, and he was saying that I think it was the 5th of April they're going to put out their sort of like plan for travel, and that's all this. The different zones and things, you know, different countries will go into different zones as to what applies to them, whether you can travel to them and all that kind of thing. With a view that everything would open, I think it was 17th of May, that, you know, flying should be sort of back to some sort of normality. I mean, obviously it's not going to be normal, and, you know, there's probably all sorts of restraints around it, like possible vaccine passports and stuff like that. But interestingly, Michael O'Leary from Ryanair put out a thing, you know, today saying, you know, we're going to be flying in May and June, I'm pretty sure, and politicians won't be able to resist the pressure.
Well, Michael O'Leary's always been provocative, hasn't he? I mean, the interesting thing was, it's like, what, you had that advertisement out a couple of months back, jab and go. It's like you have a jab, jump on a plane, and you're happy to go anywhere in the world. It was like thinking, yeah, that's a bit hasty, mate, at the time, you know?
And it's not helped because, you know, Europe seems to be heading towards another wave, doesn't it? And,
it does, you know, mate, it does. I mean, it'd be interesting to see where in Europe people are allowed to go, because the last thing I heard was that you can go to Europe, but only to go and visit your second home, you know, or a place that you've got of your own. So everyone's going to be saying, oh, can I, two dibs on your villa? You know what I mean? I paid to go and stay in your villa and stay with family. You can see that happening, yeah, can't you, to get around it.
Did you hear that one today that apparently Angela Merkel had said there was going to be like a 5-day lockdown around Easter. I've no idea when Easter is. But apparently she's now rode back on that and said, well, actually, there's not going to be a 5-day lockdown. So, did you hear that?
I didn't, Pete. It does make me wonder, though, exactly what they're looking at regarding the decision making, because it seems very, very erratic to me. You know, they're saying within any 24-hour, things can change. You know, we had that with Macron regarding the AstraZeneca vaccine. You know what I mean? And
Oh, yeah.
then they backtracked. So I don't know, mate. Until something gets written into law, it's just, for me, it's just noise at the minute. I'm just trying to get myself away from some of the noise, unfortunately, mate.
Yeah, but it's interesting because it implies that Merkel's under a lot of pressure, to open up. And the idea of a fight, well, they were saying that, a lot of the German population are not very happy about it. So, if that means that Europe's going to open up more, possibly that will mean that the economic situation in Europe may ease a bit. But then again, if the pandemic gets too much, then it's going to put people off doing things. So, it's so much uncertainty, isn't there?
There is, mate. There certainly is. There certainly is.
I mean, it's like I was saying, I don't get all that sort of het up about it in terms of the markets and stuff, because what I tend to do is just look at what the charts are telling me. I mean, I do sort of believe in this theory to an extent that all of the available information in the world is encapsulated in those charts. And I think to a large extent that's correct. And when I look at the charts at the moment of the indexes and stuff, you've got the US indexes. I mean, the Nasdaq is the weakest one. I've actually got a tiny, tiny, tiny short spread bet on the Nasdaq 100, but it's really small because, I didn't want to go too big on it. It's so choppy. But that one's definitely one of the weakest indexes. The Dow has only really just come off its all-time highs, which really is just like a sort of healthy correction. Not a healthy, it's just a healthy pullback. It's not even a correction or anything like that. The German index, the DAX, it's just come off a little bit from all-time highs. So, these are markets that are actually pretty strong, as I say, apart from the Nasdaq. Nikkei's interesting because it might have done a double top. And I find that one quite fascinating.
It's
But
sorry,
I'm
go on,
not going
sorry.
to worry until the charts tell me to worry, basically.
I think what's happening, Pete, is some people are worrying a little bit more maybe than they should, and that's primarily because they're in certain stocks. And we had this conversation in podcast 42, 43 and 44 about value and growth and people moving from growth towards the value stocks. So the very, very high PE racy stocks that have done exceptionally well since the market bottomed around March 23rd, 24th of last year, those stocks that are up 100%, 100 plus, percent, they've eased off a lot. But unfortunately, a lot of the momentum investors are in those stocks. So they're worrying now about whether or not the peak is in for their stock going forward, because lockdown could be easing. And therefore, some of the growth that they've had because of lockdown may not happen now.
I definitely sense that. I mean, one of the companies that reported today was Bloomsbury, BNY. I think you hold it, don't you?
Bloomsbury, I used to hold that, Pete, and I sold out of
Okay.
it last year. Yeah.
Yeah, well, it's interesting because they came out with really good results again. I think they upgraded their already upgraded expectations. But I can't help thinking with Bloomsbury, and they did hint at this in their commentary, that what is going to happen to that after lockdown? Is a lot of their boost down to lockdown? The fact that we can't do anything else, so we might as well read a book. And I wonder if there's an element of that in their numbers. It's there's other ones like the video gaming stocks that have done well through lockdown. Personally, I think they're going to continue doing well because I think there's such a revolution going on in video gaming in general.
Yeah, I think some of the trends that we're seeing at the moment will some of those will continue. I think people will still continue to do a lot of gaming per se. Whether or not we've talked about Halfords, I think because we're going in the summer, people will still be buying the bikes. I think that's going to still. I think there's a shortage. In fact, I've read somewhere as well, Pete, regarding bikes. So that'll still do for Halfords, and that other smaller company, Tandem, will do well. We talked about the ventilation company, Volution Fan. I think they will continue to do well. B&Q will still do well. Of course, the education companies will do well. Pearson and, like you've mentioned, Bloomsbury regarding their books. And
didn't Pearson, P-S-O-N, didn't it put out a warning the other day?
I don't think it was a warning. It was. Some people class it as a mild. Yeah, probably class it as a mild warning, Pete. But they're doing better than they feared they were doing. But it still wasn't great. If you know what I mean.
Okay.
The e-learning side is growing. I wanted to quickly point out a few things about the psychology of the markets, Pete. And there was a great article that I saw that was talking about the pain of crashes, market crashes. Yeah. And on a scale of 1 to 20, bizarre, believe it or not. The one that we had more recent, going from the high December 2019 to March low of 2020 to where the market had bounced back, the COVID pandemic crash, is classed as a pain factor of 1, right?
Right.
So that was the decline of 20%, Pete. But it's looking at the speed of decline to the speed of recovery. Yeah?
Yeah.
And then you've got the likes of the 1929 crash and Great Depression, which goes from August 1929 to May 1932, and the recovery didn't happen until November 1936.
Oh.
Yeah. So you see where I'm going there with the pain indication there, the pain index there for it's 100. That's the highest and the longest and the deepest sort of depression that we've got. So what we had last March through to July to get back to that 20% decline and back again and recover was the shortest and sharpest that we've ever had.
But the thing is, we wouldn't... That pain index only sort of works for hindsight, doesn't it? Because we wouldn't have known at the time that it was going to recover so fast.
Absolutely, and this is why... We can't say, and the point I'm trying to make here is that we've got to make sure that people learn the lessons of this last one, but don't be complacent that the next one, and there will be a next one, is going to be as short and as sharp and as quick a recovery as this one we've just had, you know? So be prepared to have your stocks flexible and not to get tied in and married to any sort of stocks. There's market risk. There's always going to be volatility, folks. So just be careful with what you look for in your particular stocks, and don't get married to a stock. Yeah, and don't, you know, we've talked about bullying before. Don't, just because someone comes out and says something not so bullish about your stock and not so positive about your stock, and they're questioning and challenging, don't be that sort of person that goes on and goes rah, and has a go at that person just because they're questioning and challenging this very, very racy, highly priced stock that's up 100% and 200%. Just take it and be objective. You know, if you've been objective, you can see the positives and see the negatives, and you can accept someone else's viewpoint on that particular company.
And as we always say, you know, it's always worthwhile embracing. If you're long on a stock and you're a bull, it's always worth embracing the bear side of the argument, because they might, you know, have a really good point that you haven't realized that could be extremely material. I mean, a lot of the time, you know, it may be trivia, in which case you can sort of just ignore it as noise. But sometimes people do come out and say, you think, oh, blimey, actually, that is a really key issue. I need to be careful on this one.
Absolutely, absolutely. Now, Pete, is there anything else you want to add before we bring in our tasty little guest?
Yeah, one thing I will just say, sort of related to that, I was reading something somewhere, and I'll feel terrible if I've got one. Well, I won't feel that bad, but I'm not gonna you know, jumping under a bus or something because of what I'm about to say. But I'm going to attribute this to a former CEO of Aberdeen Asset Management, and it may be someone entirely different. So apologies if you're listening, it was you. But basically, I read it somewhere. This person said, running a fund like Aberdeen, well, running any fund, was not about picking stocks. They said anybody can pick a good stock. It's really not about picking stocks. He said what it's about is avoiding the losses, and when you do have a loss, you minimize it. And I thought that's quite an interesting, you know, and relevant point along that lines of having a diversified portfolio and not, you know, not getting overconfident and having too much just in a very small collection of stocks.
Yeah, I think that's a good point, well made there, Pete. I mean, the importance really for me is about having that mindset where you know full well that you have to, you know, whilst you're celebrating the good and your stocks are going up and the markets are going up, you've got to brace yourself for when the markets wallops you across the chin and gives you a surprise. And I'll talk about one of my surprises that I had yesterday a bit later on in this particular podcast regarding a stock where it's almost like I'd got a punch on the chin from a professional boxer. So we'll talk about that in a little while. But before I do that, Pete, just on the FTSE, Pete, we're 1 year in from the market crash. We've had a high of 6873 on the FTSE 100. We had the low of 54155, and today we're at 6712. FTSE All Share, we had a low of 2680, and today we're at 3826. So we've had a fair bit of recovery all around the market, really. But what happens next? And regarding this third wave in Europe and talk about inflation and all the rest of it, I don't know. I think that's a good segue into our expert that could share some insights as to what his thoughts are on the market. Shall we bring him in?
Wheel him in, mate. Wheel him in.
Okie dokie. Ladies and gents, our listeners, our global listeners on this Twin Peaks podcast, we have the great privilege and honour to have a very, very special guest today for you all. And he's none other than Tim Rogers, the former CEO of AB Dynamics PLC. And Tim is a owner and non-exec of numerous companies, SMEs, and a business development chap. He's got loads of experience in advanced engineering, 20 years of operating as a CEO, senior director and board level. And he works with lots and lots of different companies all around the world. He's very, very sought after. So we are blessed to have him. Tim, are you there, fella?
Yes, I am. Are you sure you're talking about me?
Well, that's what, you know, well, this is what I've written about you, mate. I've got to give you the best intro that I possibly can. If correct anything I've got wrong there, though, please.
I was just hoping you could read my writing. That was all.
Yes. Yeah. I'll be asking for the check in the post, mate. How are you doing, Tim?
Yeah, very well. Thank you very much. And good to hear you. And I think, although I've heard you, Pete, the other Pete, I don't think I've ever met. So good to speak to you both.
Yeah, no, great to talk to you. And we obviously need to talk about your massive motorcycle collection and your car collection.
Oh, okay, that's what we're here for.
not quite, Tim. We'll have a little segue into that at some point, most definitely. Sure. First and foremost, thank you ever so much for coming on our little podcast. I wanted to just gauge, you know, Pete and I were talking about the markets. It's been a year since, you know, we've all been in lockdown, but focusing on the markets per se, what's been your reading of it in a sense of the markets have, you know, given people an absolute rollercoaster of a ride in the last 12 months? And I wondered, A, how you navigated it and what your thoughts have been, having watched over the markets, you know, I don't know, probably longer than Pete and I have looked at the markets.
Well, I tell you, I'm glad I'm not a CEO of a company at the moment. I would not like to be in their job. I mean, I think what has been quite interesting to me is how well companies have pivoted and changed their plans. Certainly the companies I've been working with and advising have done a very good job, a quick, fleeted job of understanding that this might be a short-term issue, basically reallocating their resources, making sure the staff is safe. That's been quite impressive. On the downside, I suppose, I've seen a number of really good companies that were eyeing up maybe an IPO on AIM or other exchanges either shelve their plans or go down the private equity route. And I think that's a shame, because I think that's starved the market of a couple of potentially really good companies. It's just been an unbelievable thing, really, to watch. In fact, you get so inured to the news, you know, when you hear news that Debenhams are shutting or this is going to the wall, it doesn't really register anymore. It doesn't, something that would be massive if in normal times just seems to just pass the news. Okay, oh yeah, well, that was expected. And I think we're getting very used to receiving bad news on the financial side. But at the same time, you know, you can see that other parts of the world like China have bounced back, and Japan, you know, starting to bring itself back into the market again. And You guys talk about the stock markets. I mean, I don't really know why the indices in the US are at the all-time highs, but when some of the companies themselves are struggling on it. But we're in a different game, and I'm glad I don't really follow those markets too closely.
Yeah, it's a very interesting time going on. I mean, going back to the companies that we've lost, listed or unlisted, I mean, the most recent one that just panged a little heartstring with me was Thorntons. It was like the first main chocolate company that I knew of, and it was like a very, very, very big deal if you ever got any chocolates, you know, when I was a kid, from Thorntons, you know.
Yes,
and then
I know.
When I grew up, there was a retail outlet of Thorntons everywhere. And to imagine that now, you'd be walking in various different shopping centres or high streets to not see a Thornton's. It's a bit like X amount of years ago when Woolies went. It's like massive.
It is. And, you know, what I'm not too sure about, I mean, there's other companies out there like Hotel Chocolat who probably set up business models based on the Thornton model, whether they're going to have that as an opportunity. I mean, the trick, it seems to me, is that those guys, those companies that are sitting on good access to capital, either their own capital or other people's capital. In fact, we've seen a couple of companies last year being able to go out and raise some money, you know, and I think stockholders feel that they have to dig their hands in their pockets to support a company, otherwise they might lose them. The biggest of which, I think, was the cash raised by Rolls-Royce. We all believe we're going to be flying in planes in the next you know, decade or so I guess it's a good bet. But there's got to be a point where if you're a company or an investor investing in a retail company on the high street, you know, there must be the writing on the wall for those companies to look at it and think, can we go out and get a cash rise? No, I don't think it's going to happen. And they save themselves the ignominy of not being able to raise the money and having to close the company under duress.
It's an interesting one, Tim, with Rolls-Royce, because in a way they were finding life tough before the COVID crisis anyway. And
yes.
You know, they've got the transition from you know, what's it, aviation fuel powered planes and engines to something in the future, hydrogen or whatever it's going to be, who knows. So they've got so many challenges, so investing more money in those for a lot of these big investors, it seems a very brave call to me. I don't think I'd want to buy shares in Rolls-Royce at the moment.
No, I mean, I it's one of the stocks I do hold. I've just never released it. I mean, maybe sentimental. There were a couple of engineers I met during the time, you know, when I used to go to some of the sort of lectures in London. And I heard someone give a lecture about the evolution of the RB211 engine, how it went completely wrong for them. And in the end, the government stepped in and put the money in and save them from bankruptcy. And the direct evolution of that was the Trent engine, which now powers a huge percentage of the giant jets around the world. And if the UK government hadn't come and done that, then Rolls-Royce wouldn't be the company it was. And I think it sits on such a wealth of technology and talent that it's more than capable of meeting the challenges for the future.
Mm.
But its main issue really was that it bet a lot of money on building powerful engines for large things like the A320 and the A340 and the A350, the big machines.
Yeah.
And there's quite a lot of, and there's a lot of competition up there at the moment. You know, they're up against the United Technologies, Pratt and Whitney, all these kind of people. But I think they're going to be okay, because basically the military spending is going up around the world. They've sort of right-sized themselves, and I think they are sitting on a good technology pool, and I think they've now got the cash to get them out of the trouble. But
I'd see it as one of those stocks that, like you, if I held them, I'd probably stick with it and see what happens. But would I buy it? I probably wouldn't, because there's probably other things that would take my fancy more.
Oh, for sure.
I know that's a strange distinction. A lot of people wouldn't agree with that. They always think something's either a buyer or isn't, you know what I mean? But I sort of have these slight distinctions with the way I do things. It's a bit weird.
Well, back in 2008, the Rolls-Royce shares dropped right back down again, and they popped straight back up to where they need to be. Mm. I mean, I wouldn't go as far as saying that they're a bellwether of global trade and business, but There's a lot of companies in the UK, like, you know, companies like Babcock and BAE Engineering, you know, great people, great technology, but where the hell are they going to sell their products? And I think a lot of people are wondering themselves.
Yeah, that's very true. And I think a lot of them, again, are, you know, very dependent on Rolls-Royce, aren't they?
Yes, they are. Yes, they are. And I mean, I guess a lot of the thing really is, you know, it's the same kind of with the automotive industry. You know, it's a massive multi-billion pound company industry around the world. But, you know, it's faced a serious knock this year. And there's still some legacy issues in that market, which are yet to play, not least of which I don't think we've seen the end of the Dieselgate and the electrification of cars and the introduction of driverless. You know, I've been watching with a bit of surprise to see that there's quite a strong sentiment towards the Volkswagen Group. Its shares have been moving. People are talking very positively about them, but I don't think their problems have gone away. No way.
The interesting point about that, Tim, is that, you know, everyone's looking for someone else to compete with Tesla. Tesla's getting so much free advertising, free marketing from the noise and the musings that's going on, and the stock's absolutely been rampant. And Pete and I mentioned Tesla back in last May, podcast 22, and the share price was $163 at the time. And they hit a high later in the year of $900.39, and they're now sitting at $657. And he's been talking on the last few days about, oh, you can buy a Tesla with Bitcoin, you know, and all that noise. But I think, you know, for me, I thought the Volkswagen situation and the legacy issues and the Dieselgate stuff had finished. And all this talk now about and this marketing around electric vehicles, I was thinking, well, that's going to be a really good, no, excuse the pun, a really good driver for them and their shares, you know, because they're going to have to get away from diesel. They're going to have to get away from petrol. They're going to have to get away from and get in. And that was going to be their baby. And they're going to compete against Tesla because they've got all the infrastructure and Germany can't afford to let them fail.
No, I think that is true. They are almost too big to fail. I mean, someone told me the other day that nearly 8 out of the 10 people working in Germany in some form or other are connected to or work for automotive industry. Wow. So it's massive to them. And the other thing they've also done is that a lot of the satellite countries around them, like Poland and Hungary and Turkey, have massive component industries that supply the German machine. So it's vital for them to work. But, you know, there's a lot of stuff on the horizon. You know, Tesla have done something unusual. They've started at the top end, which, of course, making an electric car 10, 15 years ago, it made sense to actually make an expensive car because you'd use the best batteries, the best motors. Nissan tried the other way around. They went in with a very low-cost car and tried to sort of trade upwards and go upwards in quality, whereas Tesla are gradually moving their product line down the food chain. A company like Tesla doesn't have any legacy engine plants out there. It hasn't got any legacy development. It started from a complete clean sheet in terms of its architecture, the way it approaches cars. It doesn't have to follow any prescribed doctrine that the Germans have to. And you've got a situation, I think, where you've got, you know, 3 major German car companies making products that are pretty close to each other in terms of how they look, how they feel, how they're driven. They all tend to use the same software to develop the car. And, you know, level 3, which is what Tesla is, you know, embracing in terms of its driverless tech, that's a start. But if we start towards move towards level 4 and 5 in terms of autonomous driving, that will kill off huge swathes of the car industry. Because basically, you're going to have a car, you know, your car that sits on your drive is a huge asset to you. And even if you used it every day to go to work, you're never in it for more than 2 hours. That means that your car is sitting in its drive for the majority of the time, not being used. Well, if you talk about level 4 and 5 car technologies in terms of autonomous, that becomes ride sharing. You know, you summon the car and it comes to you and you get off and go somewhere. So you're not going to need a super duper car with great handling and all these features on board. You're just going to need a pod that's got a decent ride. And that's got to be a massive fear to the car companies. And it moves way beyond electrification. It basically moves to where a decision has to be made on the legislation whether level three can be accepted on the roads. And if it can be, then level four and five can't be far behind. And I think the car industry, as we know it, is going to look completely different in 10 years' time.
That's a very, very, very good point you've made there. I mean, I think the concern for most countries is that they've fallen behind Tesla and they're all playing catch-up, I think, is what you've touched on there. And, you know, as you've touched on regarding Germany and Europe, they can't afford for one company to monopolise this. Otherwise, as you say, it's going to kill their industry, millions of people involved in it. And so yes. Therefore, where do they then place these workers and where do they get their revenue and taxes from if people aren't able to work in an industry?
Yeah, and if you ask you know, any decision maker in the European Parliament or anyone in any other government, what are you looking for? Why do you want autonomous cars? And they talk about safety, and they talk about, you know, cost of lives and being able to free up all of the roads. And in fact, it would be easier to introduce level three driving now if you took all the human drivers off the road, because it's actually the human drivers and the interaction with the driverless cars that causes the problems. Who's going to do that? You're going to have very closed communities like Singapore, maybe, or isolated communities where you could bring that about and have the money and infrastructure, because it's not just the car, it's the road. And you know, if 5G is going to be rolled out, are we going to use the same protocols to communicate from one car to another? And these are things, and I fear that this will drag in Europe because there's too many vested interests from two larger companies to have this happen.
And
I think that's the biggest issue, I think.
Yeah, that is often the case. I mean, talking about infrastructure, I'm blessed in that I live in Leicestershire, so I drive into the centre of Leicestershire quite often. And via the school run as well for my daughter. And a couple of weeks back, we had to take my daughter back to school for the first time in several months. So a particular route I go on, we've got a Foss Park establishment there, which has got lots of the big shops. And there's a new next shop going up. And they're putting in place Tesla charging points. That's the first ones I've seen in Leicestershire. Right. So the infrastructure's going, but it's just bits and bats, isn't it? You know, you've got to travel 100 miles and plot your route as to when you can get to a charging point, whether it be a Tesla charging point or another charging point for your electric vehicle. So that, as you say, the infrastructure's a long way away. So let me ask you this question then, Tim. You've mentioned Tesla, Volkswagen, and so on and so forth. And obviously you were at AB Dynamics, so you know the engineering, you know the automotive industry quite well. If you were to say, right, I've got my ISA money going in on next month, April, right? I'm going to put the lump of my ISA money into a stock regarding the future of automotion. Which stock would you choose?
I'd go Nissan and Tesla.
That was answered very quickly, mate. You've thought about this already, haven't you?
Well, I just thought about, I mean, I'm just looking at which companies are better prepared for electrification and which companies are prepared for level three. That's their car companies. I mean, the thing is, Tesla is overvalued.
Yeah.
If someone like Volkswagen came along and wanted to buy Tesla, you'd argue, well, actually, for the money that you'd have to spend, you could probably build another Tesla.
Yes.
You could solve all your labor issues and pay off all your staff who are working on the engine plants and make them very comfortable. I'm just looking at the way this is going to work in the next sort of 2-3 years, the legislation is certain dragging. You know, it does require a legislative step from someone and some country to bring forward this autonomous driving. And then there needs to be a bit of a jump on the technology on the car side. You know, most of these people are still using 3D cameras and radars. And in fact, the 3D cameras and the radars are still better than the humans, but you still got to interpret all that data. Everyone talks about LiDAR being the next tech, you know, that's going to come in and make things work. But, you know, you need to sell millions of LiDAR units to bring that cost down to a usable cost. At the moment, you know, they're a couple of thousand euros each to go on there, but you need to get them down to 10, 15 euros. And you can only do that when you've got millions of these things actually on the vehicles. So there's a bit of a chicken or the egg there. But no, yeah,
what exactly is LiDAR? That's laser, is it? Is that right?
No, it's a light. It's a basically infrared light that scans out in front, and the data comes back as a data point. And then you've got quite often when you see these people demonstrating how these autonomous cars work, they all look the same. They all got this thing trundling along with a kind of spinning radar on the front. And they never seem to be going any faster than about 10 miles an hour, because I think the data that they generate is so immense that the computer's got to process the data, and it's almost too much information is coming in. But I mean, the acronym is it's light detection and ranging.
Yeah.
And it's a bit like laser imaging and ranging. It's a method of 3D scanning. It's been used for years, you know, for things like surveying. And but moving it onto an autonomous car that is moving and fixing it to a GPS system and an inertial system, boy, that's going to be a challenge. I mean, we did all this at AB Dynamics, but we sold them for about £100,000, £200,000 each for testing purposes.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's going to have to go a long way down the sort of supply chain and commoditization of the technology before we start seeing that.
Okay. With regards to ABDP, which is the ticker symbol for your former company, I'm sure you've been keeping an eye on it. And I'll ask this question because I'm sure it's burning in Pete's ear to ask you. Do you still own the shares or any shares of that company, your former company?
I don't.
You don't?
I do not, no.
Right, okay. I was going to compliment you if you had, because they were up 106% in the past year. So they've done quite well. I was wondering, I mean, do you think they're going to be needed even more so going forward regarding the technology you've spoken about?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think a lot of the ways, I don't really keep in touch. I don't know a huge amount more than you guys know, but I can see the direction that was being taken by the company to move towards the simulation and,
yes,
and digital map. Everyone talks about the digital twin. It's the big buzzword. So the car companies create a digital twin, a virtual car in a virtual space. And if you get it right, it means you can drive that car in a virtual space, i.e. you can put it on a simulator, and then you can get the test driver to drive that car even before it's gone onto the test track. And that was, you know, that was key to really understanding how, you know, you can model something and you can then build the prototype. And if your modeling is not sophisticated enough, then the prototype will not reflect what you tried to build.
Oh.
And the test driver will get in the car and say, my God, this is shit. Mm. And it's all quantify what you mean by that. All right. It doesn't handle like you told me it might do. It pitches in the corner. It's got this, it's got that. And they have to then translate that information into a digital form. And this is what the robots can do. They can drive it and provide that information. and when you're evaluating the emergency braking systems and the driverless technology on board, all that information can be taken off and it can be fed into a simulator. And I think that seems to be where ABD have done a good job. And certainly that purchase of RF Pro was spot on, because they're not quite the Microsoft of the simulation world, but they're close to it. So you've got hardware and you've got the software company all in one place, which is like an Apple model, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
And they're still able to, I think, sell, because the product is so good from RF Pro, they're able to sell it to other people. But it does mean that you can integrate that product. And I would imagine that's really the direction of where the company wants to go. And the fact it seems to be developing its distribution channels by making these acquisitions of that company in America, and that more recently that company based in Singapore. So the distribution channels are very important, plus the offices they set up in Germany. So yeah, you know, it's it needed that slightly more aggressive corporate head, the one I didn't have, to really drive that company forward to the next step and undo some of the legacy stuff that I set up, which you have to do when you take in a small company and move it forward. You accept certain things with the knowledge that you're going to have to undo it one day. But it's better to get someone else in to do that, because they haven't got the they're not wedded to it, and I think that's what's been happening.
Yeah, sorry, Pete.
Yeah,
a few questions for you. Go on, Pete.
Yeah, I was going to say. So we were talking about Tesla and the autonomous vehicles and stuff. I'm all right in thinking Google are doing a lot of work on autonomous driving and stuff, aren't they? Is that right? And is there any other companies doing stuff?
Well, there's loads. I mean, you just got to type it in. You know, type in level three autonomous, and you'll see every single company coming up. There's quite a lot of sort of fledgling companies here in the UK. And in fact, to do driverless, it's a holistic approach. You can't just go for the vehicle. It's got to be the vehicle. It's got to be the legislation, and it's got to be the technology on the road and off the road, and all those kind of things. And I think the UK is actually doing quite well there. It's quite a long way ahead. I think America is further ahead because it's got the large tech companies. So you've got Nvidia, and you've got Google, and you've got Tesla, and you've got lots of other companies all getting involved in this space. And it will be two things have to happen to make this really go: legislation and some form of harmonization of the technology. So you can't have, you know, one company using a 5G in one way and another company using 5G in another. They all have to agree what that is going to be.
A bit so like what we, it's common standards, isn't it?
Yeah, like what happened with the mobile phone companies many years ago when they sat down and agreed on GSM. You know, it was it worked. And even sort of standards on computers, you know, how the USB works, they all agreed what it's going to be. So everyone ended up with a common. Once that happens, then I think it will move forward very quickly. And I really can't predict when that's going to be. And I can really can't predict what the appetite is, because...
Yeah, well, I think that's another factor, isn't it? It's the sort of the human side, the ergo side. You know, how much people, how user-friendly people find it and how happy they are to do it. I mean, it's going to feel so weird at the start, isn't it? Getting into your car and it's being driven for you by nobody. That's going to be really weird.
Well, no, and I've always argued when people talk about, you know, being driven. I said, well, why don't we have a thing called a taxi, you know, and the guy gets in and drives you there and it gives him a job and everyone's happy. But apparently that I've misunderstood the question, apparently. But, I mean, the other thing about it is that we don't need nice cars. We want nice cars. So all we actually need is a little Hyundai i10. That will do everything we want. But we don't want that, do we? We want to be able to
drive
a nice
car. Other
cars
are available.
Yeah, well, yeah.
Other cheap cars are available.
Well, I go back to a car that's not made anymore. Was it the Daewoo Matiz? That was always the sort of the cheapest car you could buy.
Yeah.
But that would get you to Oxford down the motorway. That would take you shopping. It would do most of the things. Even at a pitch, you could take your skis and you go skiing. But it's not that we actually need these cars. It's that we want these cars, which is why, and this is what Germany's been doing for years. It's been making cars that we want, not that we need. The Koreans used to make cars that we needed, but now make cars that we want. So they're all trying to go up this virtuous slope to the same point where they all want to make these cars. And it's getting very busy at the top, hence these consolidations we're seeing now between GM and Chrysler and Fiat. And there's going to be more of these going on. And, you know, GM sold their Opel unit, and there's loads more stuff, loads more consolidations happening. And someone will drop out. But the problem is that some of these European car companies have state money in them, and they'll be kept alive. The French will keep alive their bits, the German will keep alive their bits, and the Swedish will try and, you know, preserve Volvo with Geely.
Italian side, and
and it's not going to do it. It's going to be oversupply, and you know, the Wolfsburg plant. Turns out something like one car every 30 seconds, and it's about 2 kilometers long. It's just an amazing machine. But why are we doing that? There are less car companies in the world than there were 30 years ago, and the less car companies than there were 100 years ago. It's not helping the automotive industry, and ultimately it won't help you as the consumer, because you won't have many choices of cars, because they'll all be coming from the same basic brand.
Mm. Because of course you've got Chinese manufacturers as well.
Well, the Chinese are interested in their market. I don't really believe that they're interested in the outside market. It's, you know, they're looking at it thinking it's a bit busy, it's a bit commoditized. We'll struggle to meet them on cost. Where they're interested is that if you're an aspiring Chinese executive, it's nice to buy the Western derivative of that car. So there's a Passat, long wheelbase Passat you can buy. There are Lincolns and stuff. And I think what Chinese would like to do is produce a homegrown product that is desirable. And that's where they're working. This is probably why Geely bought Volvo. And we don't think we've seen the end of that. You know, I think they will buy themselves into a position where they'll be able to offer homegrown Chinese quality products. And that's a massive market.
That makes sense because, I mean, with the rate of growth in China and with, you know, so many people being moved out of poverty and being into more middle class, whatever, there is a huge growing market for them anyway. So as you say, why bother competing in the rest of the world more than you need to when you've got that massive market at home anyway?
Yes, I think that's it. And I think, you know, when we were ABD, a huge part of our sales of products, which are research products, so the research products that allow them to build the cars that will match the Western competitors, you know, that they invested in heavily. In fact, a lot of companies, you know, when I joined ABD, flipping out, how long ago was that now? 2012, there was a sudden surge in R&D spending by the car companies. It had gone through a bit of a doldrums in 2008, but there was a whole lot of things happening, and ABD was in the right place at the right time. And we did grow very quickly, and we were able to put in new facilities, new resources. We were able to change things very quickly, bring in new products. But the other companies in that industry were doing equally as well. You know, one of the companies that flies under the radar, I think, is Spectris. But they were acquiring companies, and they were doing quite well. There was companies like Humanetics in America, and I would go to these trade shows and see everyone doing well. So ABD was growing in a space that was growing hugely. The reason that ABD was noticed in the UK was that there weren't many companies like that in the UK. But in Germany, there were loads, and in America, there were loads. So it was, you know, we were in quite high focus, but only because what we did was unique to the UK, but not unique to the industry.
But with regards to that then, Tim, with regards to stocks in the UK or in the US, and your investing style, how do you pick companies that then you either invest in or want to support and help and transition?
Well, I've been fortunate for the last 3 years of working with private equity and family offices. I mean, there's a lot of money there. And one of the things the family offices have been doing is they've been pooling more of their resources. And, you know, when they approached to talk to me about it, they had three things I quite like the look of. They were very much into the social responsibility. They had a much higher quality deal flow and much simplified due diligence. I mean, the decision making was made almost within days. And they were increasing, they were reducing their reliance on external funds to manage their money and doing much more direct. And the four things I saw them investing in, and I believe this is really where the money is, it's all long-term stuff, but it was food, farming, clean air, clean water. That was where the majority of the billionaires' money is going into. Long-term, they look at companies with low turnovers, strong management teams. They're very keen if it's asset-rich, so land, real estate. That's the kind of thing they're really getting into. And you know, my own investment strategy has been since I've left ABD. I have purchased houses, I have purchased land, and as Wheelie Pete knows, I've also bought a few motorcycles as well, classic motorcycles, thinking that might be an alternative plan. But there is the world is awash with private equity money, and I've even seen a couple of IPOs being diverted in the last 18 months down the private equity route.
So they're grabbing them before they're IPOing, so they can't be accessed by retail and other institutions. They're keeping them for themselves to either fatten up or to strip and then IPO later on with a bit more debt, as has happened in recent times.
Well, I would say no, they're not actually. Okay. They're looking. If it fits their profile, they're looking at it. There's a lot of interest, I said, in things like clean air, clean water. Yeah. And there's quite a few companies that were looking at, you know, membrane technologies, a couple of companies looking at depollution technology. And, you know, they were subsumed by the family offices and they've been given a brief and, you know, a fairly long timeline. And it was, yeah, I mean, it felt like to the owners and the founders that they were IPOing, but they really weren't. The only thing they do have to be careful of is that there can be the long overreach of the family, and you got to pick your purchaser very carefully. But on the whole, you know, these family offices have realized that they don't know everything. They made their original money out of something, whether it be diamonds or packaging or something. But they know that people out there, if they don't understand a business, they either won't get into it or they'll find someone who does, and then they'll trust them to be able to invest on their behalf. But okay. It's got to meet that profile. You know, you can't underestimate this social corporate responsibility. They put a lot of emphasis on that. I mean, millions and millions of acres all around the world are owned by these family offices.
So Tim, just to confirm, with family offices, so is that just like if you have like a very, very wealthy family or whatever, they have their own investing office or division, whatever, that yes. goes back? Or do the family offices work for other families as well?
Well, there was a pooling of that to a certain extent. And there was a time when the family, you know, the money for the family was managed in that way. I mean, there's been a massive increase in affluent individuals. You know, we hear a lot about the sort of Russian and the Ukraine money, but there's also a lot of stuff coming in from Asia. There's the traditional families like the Quant family and the Rousing family and all that. Well, there's all pooled together. And normally, you know, the investment houses are very keen to come and sell their services to these people, but there's much more emphasis now on taking direct control. Probably because, you know, if a company was set up 50 years ago and made billions of pounds, the sons and the daughters are probably more interested in that part of it to manage the money than they are to actually manage the original business that got them there.
Yeah. Or they've sold it or whatever. Yeah.
Yes. And, you know, it's not too different to looking at a sovereign fund. You know, when you look at the Abu Dhabi Mubadala fund or the trillions of dollars sitting in the Norwegian fund.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, they deferred a lot of that decision making to institutions to manage their money for them. But I think these days a lot of it's being done more directly. I mean, I think the Norwegians have quite a large stake in Volkswagen.
Okay. So Tim, I want you to finish off by asking you a few investing questions. I mean, I'm going to make the assumptions you're still running your own ISA.
Yes.
Okay, so with regards to your ISA, obviously you're trying to buy certain stocks and funds and so on and so forth. What have you been purchasing over the past 12 months, given the volatility of the markets?
Well, I've avoided individual shares, okay. But I have actually sort of invested in. I based my decision making on fund managers I met while I was at AB Dynamics that I liked.
Okay.
and also ones that invested in me, I thought, because they, you know, obviously I thought they're clever. They know what they're doing.
No bias there then. Okay.
Yeah. So it's things like, and I also went for slightly riskier ones, but things like, you know, the Lion Trust Sustainability Fund, you know, that's done tremendously well. It's you know, good bunch of people, very clued in, you know, very keen to engage with the management of any companies they work at. And so it's funds like that. I've been doing much more in fund. I also actually bought quite a lot of physical gold, which did well for me actually, because it's, you know, it's free of capital gains. And I bought that about 3 years ago at around about $900 and sold out quite a lot recently and put that back into the funds. So it's fairly conservative. I just realized I wasn't as good at picking stock. But I thought I was, you know, I used to go along to these meetings, you know, the share society meetings, and listen to some guy from biotech company talking about his product and be really impressed and quite blown away, thinking, wow, you know,
totally taken in.
Yeah, this guy knows his stuff, you know, and people used to say to me, I guess as a CEO, Tim, you can pick a winner. I thought, well, I thought I did. But I was surprised, you know, here we are in the middle of, you know, last year in a pandemic. I said, wow, we're going to see what this technology can do. Not a thing. Dinada. So there has to be, Yeah, there has to be that internal radar. I just don't have the detail that you guys have in terms of getting in behind the numbers, looking at the data, following it. I don't have that patience, or I don't, problem is, as CEOs, is that we're not actually very good at focusing. We're generalists. We have to be, where people come in with all problems. You have to deal with it in a generalist way. You rely on the people who are the specialists to tell you the information. And I realized that that's how my investment strategy had to be. I had to pick people that I trusted and get them to invest on my behalf. And that's basically been my strategy for the last 2 years.
I think, to be fair, Tim, I think that's equally Pete's and my strategy, because what we're doing as well is we're researching companies and we're trying to find the CEOs, CFOs of companies that we trust, that have got a good history of execution and achieving goals, and not the ones that have been there, made a mess of that company, took a big salary and never achieved anything. So we're not doing that much different to what you're doing, I don't think. What would you say, Pete?
Well, it's interesting because it really comes to that classic Buffett saying of your circle of competence. It's interesting because, Tim, you seem to be saying that you've sort of, rashly thought about how you are doing things and come to a very honest and humble sort of conclusion that perhaps I'm not as good as I thought I was, and therefore I'm going to outsource some of this to fund managers and stuff,
which is the reverse to what of your listeners do, like fund managers don't know what they're doing, let's do it ourselves. And yeah. I think if you've got the talent, you can do it. My line was that not all fund managers are the same. I came across ones that I truly admired. When I was in the position to invest money again, I went back and looked at their funds, and actually I was right. I was right to admire them, because actually their funds stood out. And that's really what's been driving my investment strategies ever since.
Peter, have we got time to talk to Tim about those non-fungible token things?
No, we can talk very briefly for a couple of minutes about his bike collection though, Pete, which I know you're burning to ask him about, but just a couple of minutes, because we're already in, mate, for what is 56 minutes and we've not talked any stocks really.
I'll talk to Tim about his bikes and that another time. That's cool.
Yeah. I mean, my only advice is that, don't think you can make money out of it by restoring something, because it doesn't work that way.
Not to worry. Tim, it's been an absolute pleasure having you on our little podcast, mate. We'll have to have you back at some point. And at some point or other, Pete and I are potentially going to be on the road, so we'll be able to share a pint or two with you down south somewhere. That would be an absolute pleasure and honour for us to have you there.
No, I look forward to it. Thank you so much for your time.
And thank you for sharing those insights on the automotive industry as well.
No problem at all.
Delight.
Cheers, mate.
All right, Tim. Bye for now, mate. Take care. Pete, that was amazing, mate.
Really good, wasn't it? Really good. Really useful to hear what his thoughts were about, how the whole automotive thing's going with all the autonomous stuff and the level 3, level 4, level 5, all that kind of thing. It's fascinating, and the idea that you're going to, not own a car yourself, and you're going to call them in when you need, when you need a lift to the airport or something.
Oh, yeah, the ride sharing thing is going to be huge, Pete. I mean, essentially, your car, you'll use it for your car, and then the rest of the time it can go off and actually generate revenue for you because someone else is using it. It's being shared around the community, just ping, 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 taking other people elsewhere. So you become like an Uber driver without the car, having to drive the car yourself.
Amazing.
It's huge. I thought that point that Tim made was fantastic, because we know what's going on out there regarding stock shares and people psychology. The markets are going up, so everybody's a genius now, right? Everyone's phenomenal. Look what I've done since March. My portfolio's done this, my portfolio's done that. My stock's going to the moon and all the rest of it. And his way of looking at it is like, I was a CEO and stock picking is not my bag, so therefore I'm going to outsource it to somebody else. This is a CEO with 20 odd, 30 odd years experience of working in various numerous companies saying, I don't want to do this way. I don't feel comfortable doing it this way. Let me outsource it. Whereas everyone else, including me at times, is saying, I know what I'm doing. I'm brilliant at this. I know what I'm doing. I'm great at this. Wow. I think we all need to have a little check ourselves in, mate, to reflect on this. You know, that's a massive learning curve. That's
well, I was having this exact conversation with someone last night that, you know, I always say with my portfolio, I never know which stock is going to be the one that does really well. I never know which stock is going to be the one that does really bad. I just, through experience and through track record, through having achieved it, I know that my collection of stock, my portfolio overall, will roughly make probably about 10% a year. I don't know how that's made up in terms of the individual companies, but the portfolio as a whole will achieve that. And I hear so many people like, oh, I got this stock's going to go to the moon. And it's like, well, how come you know that stock's going to go to the moon, but this other stock you hold won't? Or, you know what I mean? It's, and I think that's something where we all need to be a bit more humble, really.
I think it's that thing about cognitive biases, Pete. Either it's because we've got too much cash leveraged into that one particular company, i.e. it's our number one holding, you know, for me, AstraZeneca. So you've built it up and you built it up and you've had it for a number of years. So you're naturally biased towards it, you know, and some people are so biased towards it, they can't hear anyone say anything slightly negative about it. Everyone's got to talk bullishly about it. Otherwise, you get blocked, muted or abused on Twitter or across social media. And if you're objective enough, actually, you should be able to listen, like you say, to other people's point of view on that stock, whether they hold it or not, or whether they hold, you know, a smaller percentage or volume of financial exposure to that particular stock. You should be able to listen to what they've got to say, because they might come out and say something and share something with you that absolutely helps you and saves you losing money going forward. You know, and the classic example is obviously Fevertree, that was getting ramped to the, you know, to beyond belief between 2019 and 2020, and is now just trapped there in that £20, £22 range. And no one, very few people are talking about Fevertree anymore, Pete, but it was the go-to stock of 2019 and 2020.
Yeah, well, I got really lucky because I bought into Fevertree and I actually top sliced it almost at the perfect time. That never happens normally.
Well, it's rare that you top slice and sell anything, Pete, so that is rare.
Yeah, that's rare, but actually getting it even remotely near the top is absolutely incredible. But I've still held on to Fever. I've still got some, and I really like it going forward. You know, 3, 4, 5, 6 years in the future, I think Fever will be brilliant. And I, you know, I am looking to buy more of it, but I'm biding my, well, I haven't got any money. If I had some money, it's definitely one on my radar of things to top up on.
But so are you fully invested right now, Pete?
Pretty much, yeah.
So the conversation we were having last year about cash is king and we should have some cash ready to pounce if there's an opportunity.
Yeah.
You've just got cash in your spread betting account, no doubt.
Yeah, I've got cash, you know, in my spread betting account, and I've got cash lying around that I can get hold of if I need to. But okay, in terms of what I want to commit to my stocks, like in my main ISA sort of thing, I'm just fully invested. And the thing is, that's the way I tend to work, because I tend to use hedging. So,
yeah,
you know,
yeah,
sort of slightly different. I mean, I actually prefer to be pretty much invested all the time if I can. And if I see cash sat there doing nothing, I'm thinking, why haven't I got that cash in?
No, I fully understand that, mate. I mean, The reason why I keep cash is always if there's an opportunity to add somewhere, it gives me that optionality to add some more or to buy something that I think's in bargain territory. And I've been, you know, as I've said to you before, I've been going further and further up the food chain. But we haven't got time for me to talk about some new stocks that I bought of late, and I'll talk about that in the next podcast. What I want to share with people is this lesson that I got given yesterday, and this was I've got a real dislike for intraday RNSs. I don't want an RNS between 12 o'clock and 4:30 when the market, before the markets are shut, because I want to get over my life. I want to look at the RNSs in the morning, do nothing or something, and then I want to get on with my day. I don't tend to look at the RNSs during the day. So
7 o'clock in the morning.
So yesterday afternoon, I'm getting myself ready. I'm off for the school run, picking my daughter up. I come back home. I have a quick look through some of the stocks. I'm going, sorry, I think my computer's showing something wrong on here. What's going on here? And Ixico, one of my favoured sort of tech, AI, health sort of stocks, been doing quite nicely. Came out with a nice little Microsoft sort of deal recently. It's going back up. It's been drifting for a little while. Ended up being knocked, Pete, by 39%.
Oh.
Right? Down to 64 pence. Now, put this into context, right? It dropped 41 pence, right? Yesterday afternoon in the space of an hour and a half, 2 hours, right? And that's versus the purchase price I made of the stock at less than 26 and a half pence, right? On the 25th of April in 2019. So it'd gone up to a pound odd and then dropped 41 pence in one single day. So I put a gif out of a guy being knocked out on, you know, boxing match, because that's how it felt. I was like, wow. Absolutely stunned by it. And then this morning it dropped again because people just panicking as to what's going on and what does this mean, them losing this massive contract for this Huntington disease phase 3 contract. So I purchased, because I've got some cash, I purchased some more today at 60 pence. We'll see what happens. Okay. You know, I trimmed it at £1.40. I trimmed it before at 70 odd pence last year when Simon Thompson put a stop loss in regarding it and said to trim. But yeah, I bought some more. And but so that Simon, yesterday was a big, big knock.
Simon Thompson's probably still covering it, I think, isn't he? So it'd be interesting to see what he has to say about it.
Yeah,
because the good thing, the good thing about the IXI update was that it did give quite good guidance on what the revenue and the earnings impact was. So yes. that's a good thing. It's worse when they say we've lost the contract and it's going to be terrible, and they tell you nothing more. There's no numbers. At least if you've got some numbers, you can work on it. And that's what I'd imagine Simon Thompson will be doing.
He might come out and say something, but you might not. I'm not that bothered. I'm just looking to see what they do over the. I'm looking to see if they win some further contracts elsewhere, so they don't have too dominant a number one client, which can impact them like this. And this is what any company should do: have a diverse sort of income stream, and not just have one client that makes up 20, 25, 30% of their income. You know, it's always a danger, and that's what's happened on this occasion.
Interesting. I also know is that today it's put in a hammer candle. So, you know, so that's a hammer reversal. So the price was driven down and then the bulls have come back in and driven it back up again. So that's the first sign that the bulls are trying to stabilize the price. So fingers crossed that might help.
We'll see, mate. I wanted to touch on a couple of stocks, Pete, we spoke about historically since March onwards. Going back here to podcast 18, we spoke about InterU and our concerns about that company, and obviously then it delisted and it's gone. And podcast 19 on March the 21st, that was published, and we recorded it on the 19th. We talked about Games Workshop, and on the 19th it hit a low of £35.90, and then later in the year it went to £121.40. Today that closed up at £95.05, so that's had a really good run in the past past 12 months, that particular stock, Games Workshop.
Were we positive on Games Workshop back then? Or...
I think we were talking about cash, Pete, and opportunities to buy at its lows on that particular podcast, I think.
Okay.
Going back. We spoke about Tesla we recorded it on the 15th of May, podcast 22 back in May.
I've been totally wrong with that.
Recorded on the 20th, and the share price on the 20th for Tesla was $163.11. It went on to hit a high of $900.39, and it's currently at $657. We spoke, I think you spoke about, I can never pronounce it, Lucio or Luceco.
Yeah, Luce, yeah.
Luce, ticker symbol LUCO. Recorded that on the 3rd of June. And at the time it was £1.05. It hit a high of £2.90, and that's at £2.69 at the moment. And in podcast 33, we recorded and published on the 7th. It was 7th of October. It's £1.15. And today it's at £2.72. So anybody that researched that and took our little mentions about it and went away and did their research on those stocks, well done. Happy days. Well done.
Yeah, I mean, I think We were talking about this the other day. I think when we look back about the stocks that we've talked about, we've got quite a few wrong. There's no doubt about it. But actually, we've got quite a few right. And one that stands out to me is RMG, Royal Mail, RMG, that you talked about. It's done absolutely brilliant, that one. It's shot up.
I think that surprised everybody, Pete, because there's been perennial trouble and strikes and this, that and the other. And the COVID came along and they were like, we're so busy, we need to get more people in. You know what I mean? They're recruiting throughout Christmas and before Christmas. And normally they recruit at Christmas anyway, but they're recruiting in the summer because we're getting so busy. You know, people sending cars everywhere because they couldn't travel and see people. So they've been on the boom, mate.
Other ones we talked about, I remember things like Vistry, you know, the house builder, VT1. Yes. We talked about house building in general and said, yeah, it looks a pretty good sector. And we've been pretty much on the nail with that. So that's been good. Pets at Home, we talked about. That's done really well.
Well, you own pets, don't you? So you've had absolutely popped on that one, mate. And then everyone cycling, not enough bikes, Halfords as well, that popped.
Yeah, you did brilliant. You called that, mate. That was absolute belter, that one.
I mean, this is the problem. We're mentioning these stocks. We don't have any, you know, apart from the odd ones that you've had, Pete. We don't own them, so we're just mentioning them to people to go and do their research. But you know, these stocks have done exceptionally well, so it's good to be able to mention them, and other people, our listeners, have done well out of it. So I'm really, really pleased about that.
Well, this is the thing, and it's like the simple fact is you cannot hold every potentially good stock there is, and you know. Doing what we do, we're always going to have loads of stocks that interest us that for whatever reason we don't buy because we've already got other things.
Absolutely. Pete, I'm conscious I've not asked you about one stock that you wanted to mention, mate, and we run out of time. Have you got one that you can quickly just share with us?
Well, one I'll throw in very fast is SPE, Sofion.
Well, that's been around for a while, a tech company, yeah.
Yeah, I think they had results today, I think it was. But they were, you know, good, decent, positive results. And they made the point that the whole sort of like lockdown and rapid change and all the rest of it plays to their strengths because they make software that's to help companies with innovation and with R&D. And they're going from a sort of normal software sold under license model to go into a software as a service model. So to get more predictable recurring revenues. I think as a buy and hold, nice, decent tuck away stock, I think that one could be really good. I don't hold it, but it's definitely one that interests me.
I'll just put up the notes on here, Pete, and it's got net cash and no debt, which is really nice for a tech company. And it's paying a dividend, mate. So that's unusual for a tech company to be throwing out some divvies. So that's not bad. They've been around for a while.
Quite unusual because I don't know any other companies. I don't think there's any listed that do that kind of innovation software.
Okay, I'm moving to software as a service as well. So that's interesting. Okay, SPE the ticker there. Yeah.
Yeah, SPE.
So it's off just slightly today, 3% at 865. It's up 66% over the past 12 months. It's up 6% year to date. It's got a price range of, pretty square here, Pete, £5 and £10 is a 52-week range. So it's almost in the middle there, mid Fibonacci sort of level there, at £8. £8.65. So mid-ish, £7.50 and up. And then after that, you've got £8.50. So yeah, upper part of the Fibonacci range there.
I think it's another one of these that was all the rage 2 years ago and everybody on Twitter was talking about Sofion and then it's sort of gone off the boil and you never hear it mentioned these days.
Yeah, I mean, there's a stock that I want to mention that's a local one to myself and it's called Sanderson's, Pete.
SND.
SDG, I think it is, Sanderson's.
Is it? Oh, I thought it was
Sanderson Design Group. I'm talking, Pete. SDG.
SDG.
Yeah. It's because it's got part of its factory not far from me in Loughborough.
Yeah.
So that's one. It used to be called Walker Greenback. Remember? Remember that
right.
one?
Yeah.
And I completely missed it, mate. And it's been on an absolute tear since. I mean, it changed its name, and people used to go poo poo the stocks that changed their name. For a variety of different reasons. Since then, the low in the past umpteen months, going back to December, 73 pence on the 11th of December, and today it's closed at 129, and it came out with a trading update earlier on in the month, which was absolutely bells and whistles. So that's another one which people should maybe keep an eye on. I'm not saying it's you know, one to chase, but definitely one to keep an eye on, because the trading updates have been really, really good so far. And obviously it fits in again with that sort of viewpoint, Pete, that people are, use the word again, titivating their house, you know, redecorating and doing stuff DIY. So all the wallpaperings and all the rest of it, that's what they do, and other stuff as well as that, furnishing group, luxury interior design stuff.
Yeah, well, I know Walker Greenbank, what was WGB that's become this. Yeah. I know that quite well because I used to hold the shares. And they have things like they own the rights, the intellectual property, whatever, to all of the, what's that really famous wallpaper stuff? Not Inigo Jones, that's something else, isn't it?
Harlequin.
What was it?
Is it Harlequin?
Yeah, no, there's another one. Oh, William Morris, isn't it?
William Morris. Okay.
Yeah, William Morris. It's like a sort of iconic, legendary brand in the whole luxury thing. It's been around forever in the whole sort of wallpaper. I mean, personally, I find it horrible, but that kind of thing is worth a, you know, it's a really sort of, it stood the test of time kind of brand. And they've got all sorts of stuff like that, from what I understand.
Yeah, I mean, they've got Zoffany, Harlequin,
yeah,
Anthology, Clark and Clark. But yeah, it's a luxury end of the market, mate. And there's lots of very posh people in around Loughborough and Rutland Water and Melton that will be having buying those sort of fabrics at you know, and wallpapers at the very top of the market.
It's quality end. So
yeah,
that's
absolutely. Now, Pete, I'm conscious of the time, so I quickly wanted to say a big thank you to all of our listeners. I'm still waiting for a shout out from the folks that are listening in Paderborn in Germany. I've not had any response, so I'm going to give them a shout out again to give us a call. I also want to say thank you ever so much for all of the people that have donated to the Men Fis charity for disabled young people. We've actually triggered that point, ladies and gents, where we're over £1,000 now. So I want to thank everybody that's supported us so far regarding that, and we'll carry on pressing forward with regards to trying to get that figure above 2,000 is our next goal for that, and hopefully we can do that before we get to Christmas and move on to the next level, which would be £3,000 for that. But I wanted to thank everybody for making their donations so far. Really, really appreciate that. It's very, very generous of all you guys and ladies to make the donations that you have so far. And if you haven't and you're considering it, just go on to Pete's website, my website, or onto the Just Giving page and look up the Twin Pete's Challenge, and you'll find us on there.
Yeah, on my website, if you go to the Twin Pete's Investing Podcast page, it's right at the top. There's a link. Just click it. It takes you through, and you can make your little donation, whatever you want to give. No problem at all. Thank you.
Absolutely. Pete, is there anything else you wanted to add?
Well, something I want to throw in quickly is that our wonderful sponsor, SharePad and ShareScope, have been really helpful because they've given us a special code thing. So basically, if someone wants to use SharePad or ShareScope, if you go to the SharePad website and if you go to where it's subscribe, there's like a box that says promo code. If you just type in their Twin Pete's in lowercase, that's Twin Pete's, then basically you qualify for the 1 month of data free. And the way it works is if you sign up for like monthly payments, then the second month you get free. Don't ask me why that's the way it works. If you want to do the full yearly thing, you pay for 12 months, you actually get the 13-month free. So that's how it works.
Brilliant. Now, Pete, we're going to say ta-ra at this stage, mate, because we're running 1 hour and 19 minutes.
Yeah, we need to. Yeah,
so thank you all for listening. Thank you all for your feedback once more. It's been absolutely phenomenal, the feedback we've had for 43 and 44. This is Twin Peaks number 45. We'll await your feedback and your thoughts. I want to say really, really big thank you to Tim Rogers, who came on and shared some insights, some stuff that he did regarding the automotive industry I didn't have a clue about. So thanks ever so much to Tim for joining us as our special guest. And I hope you guys enjoyed Tim's insights regarding what he had to share with us.
What's Tim's Twitter handle?
Ah, I will find that for you. One second.
Yeah, good job I remember that.
Secondo. Just type in that.
While he's looking, I'll just
okay, say. So that's at Tim Rogers, plural Tim Rogers, 1962, at Tim Rogers 1962, and you can find Tim there, and he's always shares some really good insights as well.
Excellent. So I just want to throw in quickly is that we've had a load of questions about spread betting. We do intend to cover it on the podcast, a future podcast, but we had the opportunity to get Tim on, so you know, we thought that was a good idea to take good advantage of him while he was keen and eager.
Well, the great thing about Tim being on is that Tim's going to give us insights of where we can make money with a low risk sort of agenda, Pete. Spread betting is not always good for a lot of people. Maybe.
Well,
just
yeah, you. Yeah, exactly. But then we were going to talk about sort of how I go about doing it and how you can de-risk it, basically.
Absolutely. So we'll do that another time. All right, ladies and gents, wherever you are in the world, thank you very much for listening. Wherever you are in the world, keep going. We're nearly there. There's light at the end of the tunnel. There's changes afoot. And, you know, we might hear more before we get to the next podcast about what we can do and all the rest of it. But start planning with regards to at least being able to see families, share a bench with friends and family, and being able to, you know, have less restrictions to our movements. I'm really excited about this. I'm going to be having my jab on Saturday midday, so you know, I'm looking forward to that, allowing me to go and see my parents who've been shielding for the past 18 months, and I've not seen them since December 2019, so I'm really looking forward to being able to do that. So all of you, just take care, God bless, look after yourself, look after other people, do what you can in your communities as well, and just stay safe. God bless you all.
See you all. Bye.
This Twin Peaks Investing Podcast was brought to you in association with SharePad from ShareScope, the UK's number one investment data and analysis software for private investors and traders. Visit ShareScope.co.uk and discover the advantage.